So, hi, welcome to the VFX Artist Podcast. This week we have Maria Carriero.
Hi, guys.
Lead CG artist at Freefolk. So, tell us a bit about yourself and what you do.
Yeah, well, I'm Maria. I am currently working at Freefolk. I'm a lead generalist, I guess you could say. I've been there for 4 or 5 months now, but I guess I should start where at the beginning. I'm from Mexico, so I went to school and to uni there. I did like a media design too. It was like a graphic design with a little bit of 3D. But when I got to my 3D classes, I realized that's what I wanted to do. So I found a school in LA called Novant School of Visual Effects, and I decided to pack my bags and go there for 2 more years and. It was amazing. Such a good school. I really recommend it. It's been going, I think it just turned 25 years now. It's one of the pioneers in VFX, I guess. You can still get their tutorials online. Like, you don't have to go to the school, but yeah, so good. And I got my first job in LA thanks to my teachers at Norman. One of them was working at PSYOP, Stephen Delala, who doesn't work there anymore, but he was my lighting teacher. And I guess I did a good enough job that he recommended me for an internship. And yeah, it was great.
Brilliant.
Yeah, I got to work on some cinematics and just some commercials. So that's kind of how I got my foot in the door.
So when was this, Maria?
This was, I've been in the industry 7 years now. So this was after I graduated, so maybe 2015, more or less.
Right, 2015, maybe?
Yeah, something like that. I can't remember, sorry. But yeah, I started at PSYOP. That was my first official job as an intern. And then when that internship ended, another one of my teachers at Noma recommended me for a position in digital domain. So I went there as well for a freelance project for, it was a commercial for collaboration with Ferrari and fancy watch brand called Float. I've never heard of it before, but very expensive watches, but it was really nice. I got to work with industry veterans and just learning from the very best. So yeah, it was amazing. It's an interesting place to work. But yeah, really enjoyed it as well.
Yeah, so we met at the Mill in London and like a while ago. So I just wondering, what was your journey from LA? So you've gone from Mexico to LA.
Yeah.
And then did you go straight to the UK after LA, or did you work in other studios in LA, or did you work in somewhere else? Or?
Yeah, so I finished school and then I worked in LA for 2 years, I believe. Yeah, 2 years. After DD, I went back to PSYOP because, you know, like visas and all that in the US as a Mexican, it's not that easy. Yeah. So PSYOP knew me a bit better. They offered me a 1 year visa. So I stayed with them. And then, Trump started and Brexit had just happened. So I knew that if I wanted to stay in the US, it would be a bit harder. So I kind of needed to do a jump to the UK before they change the rules, because something I didn't mention is I'm Mexican Spanish as well, so I have a Spanish passport which allows me to work in the UK at that time before Brexit happened. So because it had happened but they hadn't changed the rules yet, I managed to move and did an interview with the Mill, and thankfully they hired me. So yeah, so that was 5 years and a bit ago. So yeah, that's kind of how I started here.
Really cool. So have you always worked in commercials?
Yeah, I did a little bit of cinematics and a little bit of film, but like not a lot. It was more like helping at DD or at PSYOP and at the Mill when something came up that they needed help with. But I really wanted to work on long form, so on film or episodic, because I had been working in commercials for so long. And it is cool, you do learn a lot in commercials, and I would recommend it for anyone that is starting, because it's so fast-paced, and you get to do a lot of workflows and put on a lot of different hats that you really become a better artist. But I kind of had enough of commercials and wanted to try it in my, my skills in like a film or episodic sort of workflow, so that's why I ended up moving to Freefolk. So yeah, that's what I do.
Brilliant. Can you talk about what you're working on? I guess you're still under NDA at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, we actually just finished recently a project for Netflix. It's called Winks. So it was just released on Friday. And I don't know if you've heard of it. But
not yet, but we'll check it out.
Yeah, it's kind of like a teenager or a young adult farm-based. It's, I guess, the easiest way to explain it would be like Harry Potter, but instead of wizards, they are fairies, and it's they go to this fairy school, and there's like a lot of magic effects, and you know, like monsters, and it gets pretty dark, and yeah, it's an interesting show. It was really cool to be part of it, so yeah, I'm excited to see it.
Cool, and so as a leader, you're managing a team of artists at FreeFolk?
Yeah, so FreeFolk is quite small, so it's been an interesting dynamic. And since I came into the project where it had already started, I was more like co-leading, I guess you could say, because there was a lead already on it, and he kind of took me under his wing and to show me their pipeline and the workflows, and I was involved on it, I guess, as a co-lead, I would say. So I would give my comments with fresh eyes, because I came in when they had been working on it for 8 months or so. And also did some shots of my own, so that was really cool, because I'm a lead, but I'm still an artist at heart, so I just still love to work on the box.
You got to stay on the box.
Yeah, definitely. I have to get really bored if I just tell people what to do, and you know, like, I feel like as an artist, you kind of still want to practice your skills and get in there. Leave a little bit of you.
Absolutely. Yeah. So what's your tool of choice? Is it Houdini?
Yeah, so Houdini, and I guess Maya, but these past 2-3 years I've been shifting my workflow to Houdini, because I believe it's more of the feature of the effects, and it's a lot more interesting to work with than Maya nowadays, in my opinion. So yeah, that's been my weapon of choice.
Did you find the transition easy or difficult? Or was it particularly challenging?
No, it's quite different to Maya. I guess they all do the same thing, but you just have more tools in Houdini, I would say. It's a different way of thinking, because it's node-based and it's non-destructive, which is why I like the most about it. You know, like, you have your nodes and your chain of nodes, and you can always change something. You never really, you can break it, but you can always trace it back to where it broke and fix it. And sometimes Maya is more like a closed box. If something breaks, it takes a little bit more.
You start again.
Yeah. I really like Houdini. I would recommend anyone that is starting in the industry to definitely start learning it if they haven't already.
Cool. So as a generalist, what sort of tasks are you mostly doing?
That's why I love being a generalist, because you do a little bit of everything. So you usually get involved since pre-production, well, at least as a lead. So you get scripts, you help on the bid, and you more or less see what VFX needs you're going to have, and see what kind of artists are you going to need to tackle it. So I guess you would usually start in assets. So I love asset building. I guess that's how I started, although I turned into a generalist. So modeling, sculpting, texturing, loop dev, groom, all that sort of stuff. And then I guess you would move into lighting as a generalist, because I guess you also have rigging and animation and all that, but I don't consider that a generalist sort of skill. I feel like it's too specialized. Yeah, you should leave it to the professionals. So I guess you move into lighting afterwards, and then do a little bit of slap comps to help comp understand what you were trying to do in lighting. You know, like, you have some special passes or IDs or whatever you have put in your scene to kind of help comp make the effect look better. So yeah, that's, I don't know if that answers the question.
That's cool. So, did you find that actually, because you use Nuke for slap comps, did that make it easier to transition to Houdini? Just using.
I guess it's similar idea of, like, it's node based. Of course, one is 2D, one is 3D, or I guess you could do a little bit of 3D in Nuke, but yeah, it is a similar way of looking at it. just gets a bit more complex. I'm not the best comper, so I don't know. I'm sure you could get a lot crazier in Nuke if you wanted to, but yeah, similar way of thinking. It's just everything's node-based. You can always go back or, you know, duplicate a whole branch and something else, stuff like that.
And I know you've moved everything to Houdini. Is even modeling and you were talking about modeling and texturing the asset build. Are you still doing that in Houdini as well, and sculpting and things like that?
It depends on the asset. So I still feel like hard surface modeling in Maya is a little bit better. Maybe it's because that's where I learned it, and it's pretty robust of what you can do, and it's quite easy. You can do the same in Houdini, but it would mean learning certain tools that I haven't bothered learning. I kind of focus more on my Houdini side on like the procedural modeling of things, which you can't really do in Maya. So like saying little procedural models that you know will help you in like a bigger scope project. So like, I don't know, like variations on little houses or, you know, like a bridge. It's just, it's so fast, you can literally do anything that your skills allow you to, and it's still something that I'm learning. But yeah, to your answer, I still model mostly on Maya, unless it's more procedural modeling, which I'm still kind of learning how to do. And then sculpting, I would keep the sculpting, at least the more high-end sculpting in ZBrush. And if it's like a quick sculpting, I would do it if you do need like a terrain or like just little things that you kind of need to lay down. But if it's like very high res, I would put in ZBrush. So I guess that's why I'm a generalist, because I just like all the different tools and. Yeah.
Absolutely. I think that's much harder. One thing, I mean, with as a compositor, I had to learn Shake. I learned After Effects, and then I learned Shake, and then I learned Nuke. But that's over like 12 years. I've obviously only really used one at a time. I never have to like bounce between them. Whereas I feel like as a generalist, you constantly have to add another software, even if it's just a renderer, you know, even if it's just moving from like Mantra to Arnold or Arnold to Unreal, or, you know.
Yeah, it keeps changing. So I guess you have to keep educating yourself and try not to be left behind. Because I guess something I have noticed in the industry is maybe industry veterans are a bit more reluctant to pick up new tools. But when I talk to students, they're very keen to learn, and I love seeing that. Like for example, we were interviewing for a position at Freefolk, and I was so surprised and so happy to see that this artist was starting to learn Solaris and just picking up new workflows in Houdini that the industry hasn't really moved forward on yet, because I guess it's so hard to implement in new pipelines that it really takes a few years to bring in new workflows. So yeah, I try to keep learning and to grab whatever new software, like watching tutorials as much as I can and talking to students, because they always bring in something fresh from the industry, you know. It's just good to see.
Yeah, that's very cool. Yeah. That's very cool. So are you find yourself getting involved with some of the recruitment process now? I mean, obviously you've only just started Freefolk, but...
I'm very happy. I've been fortunate enough to help on that. So we were running an internship scheme called FutureFolk. So I interviewed some people along with the head of CG, our recruiter. So we went through all the reels and just really found one person. We found two. One was for 2D, so I didn't select the 2D person. But we got an effects artist in to work on our project, so that was really cool. And
cool.
Yeah, sorry.
So as someone that reviews reels and has actually had to select people, what advice would you give for people show reels for generalists and effects artists?
Yeah, I would say obviously put your best stuff at the start. Specify what you did on it, because sometimes these are group projects, and I found that I would see the same shots in different reels because these were people from the same schools, but I didn't know what part they did on that project specifically. So Put Your Best Off at the start, because sometimes they're so long, I had to watch like hundreds of them, so I couldn't sit down and see every single piece. So put your most impactful shot at the start, specify what you did, what software did you use, what renderer, and I guess that would be it. And maybe if you're applying for a certain company, say you really like ILM or something, I would say cater to them if you can. So show stuff that they could use in their production. So if you like sculpting more like Disney character stuff or very stylized stuff, I wouldn't necessarily send it to ILM, you know? So send stuff to the studio that you're applying to that makes the most sense. Maybe that means having different reels to send to, but I think that works better. You know, if it's a feature animation studio, don't send more VFX stuff. You know, just be a bit more, make more sense.
Yeah, make it keep it targeted, and also like commercials and feature films, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, different. I guess commercials. You apply the same skill set, so. It's a shorter time frame, and you always have like a product to sell or an experience or something the commercial is for, but the skills are the same. I would say the reels could be similar.
That's interesting, because it used to be a big barrier, but I think that was also partly because of standard definition.
Yes, there's some commercials nowadays that are just blow me away. They're so amazing, and like the quality, honestly, is on par to some of the effects heavy shots in some movies, you know. So, yeah.
with the internship, so you were an intern yourself, and you're dealing with interns now. Mm-hmm. What advice do you give to people that are at an internship or a sort of some kind of apprentice or training role?
I would say be very open and willing to learn, which I think is quite obvious, but you know, just ask the dumb questions. It doesn't matter. I much rather have an intern ask me questions nonstop than to sit there being too scared to ask me what to do, or if they don't understand something on the pipeline, or you know, like something on their shot is broken, or they didn't quite understand the task that I've given them. I'd much rather have the intern just ask. I guess showing progress. So if you're an intern, probably your lead is going to ask you how you're doing at the end of the day, and like what have you been up to and all that. But I guess just showing your process, how you started with the task, and what you can show at the end of the day. I think that would be probably my advice. But yeah,
brilliant. I mean, as a lead, I had an experience where they weren't even trainees; they were sort of mid. But I might suggest a technique, and they obviously weren't familiar with it. But rather than saying, "What do you mean?" they've just gone, "Oh yeah, I'll do that." And then I've seen the next version; and they haven't done it, and they probably didn't know what it was. So. Yeah. And it is that fear. Like, no one knows everything. All of these tasks are so big. I mean, even 2D, which is, I think, not anywhere near on the level of the level of breadth of knowledge that you require as a 3D generalist. No one knows all of it. Yeah. And so when you come to Houdini, and then you're putting 2D, Houdini and ZBrush and Maya together, possibly, plus a renderer or two renderers, and some of the renderers might be quite new, like Solaris, then, I mean, people just need to ask questions and not stop. Yeah. And I think that's true for seniors as well.
I know. And, like, I also like checking in with interns and just seeing what new tools have they learned and, like, what skills they have that I don't probably have, you know, because they're fresh out of school. They probably had more time to see tutorials and, like, see beyond class or something. So there's always something to learn from each other. So I find that really cool and very interesting.
So. I mean, that's absolutely true. I mean, as a student, you have this opportunity to really dive deeply into the latest and greatest. And in production, you just have to kind of use the thing that you know is going to work, because you can't risk not delivering.
Yeah.
But as a student, you should definitely not be afraid to experiment. And,
yeah, you know. I guess the stakes are not that high when you, it's a school project, but if you have like a movie or a commercial to deliver, you can't really change your pipeline halfway. You can't really test the new tool that came out or the new render or whatever. So yeah, I like talking to students because they always have a new, fresh eyes on what's new and exciting.
Sometimes we often get very focused on the tools and the software, but apart from the actual software itself and the tools, what kind of qualities do you think make people better 3D artists?
I say just be nice and easy to work with. Like, it sounds so obvious, but you can be the best artist, but if you're just not nice to be around, people are not going to hire you, they're not going to recommend you for a job. The amount of jobs I've gotten just because people tend to like me and they recommend me and I can back it up with my work, I guess that's quite important. So, and it's the same if I know of a great artist that is also really nice to work with, of course I will recommend them, you know. So I would say that not being kind of selfish with knowledge. Like, I've seen sometimes in studios where an artist maybe has like a really interesting workflow and they're kind of, I don't want to say selfish, but yeah, selfish, like they kind of guard that knowledge. It's like, oh, I want to share this because then you're going to know this way of doing it and I'm not going to be special anymore. But I feel like if you can make production better and you've built a tool or you learn a new workflow, sharing is always good. And you know, like if you share your knowledge, you're probably going to receive something back as well eventually. So I would say that. So being nice, sharing knowledge, and just trying to keep learning. As you said, there's just always new tools, new softwares, something to learn. So don't just sit there and get comfortable because you already have a job and you know what to do. You know, just keep studying. Read all the articles, watch tutorials, you know, stuff like that.
That's brilliant. I think regarding sharing, I'd say another aspect to that is always reward the person who shares. I mean, always, like, you know, say, yeah, Maria Cariello showed me this great new workflow in Houdini that I didn't know. Mm-hmm. And it's a minor thing, but I think it gives them that immediate benefit, but it kind of encourages more people to share, maybe those that are being selfish and they see someone getting, you know, big ups and kudos and maybe even job recommendations or promotion recommendations because of stuff they're sharing.
Yeah,
that might encourage them, even if they're purely acting from self-interest, to just also share their tools.
Yeah, of course. I think that's pretty crucial, but I mean, you'd be surprised by some people just really guard their secrets.
I don't think it makes any sense as well, because I mean, what happens if they come in, if they're sick one day or they go on holiday for 2 weeks and, you know, their shot can't be moved forward.
Yeah.
Or it has to be redone because maybe they've done what they've done is perfectly fine, but because no one else knew what they were doing or nobody knew how to do it,
mm-hmm.
they just had to use a different workflow, and then suddenly whatever special sauce they'd added is lost in the final shot that goes on the show.
Yeah, I guess that it takes some time sometimes to pick up someone's shot and like, trying to see what they were doing and the process. And you learn from picking up other people's shots, but sometimes, yeah, it's you kind of need them right next to you to kind of explain what they were doing.
Are you working all in the office, or are you working from home, or is it a mixed workflow?
It's a hybrid workflow, although right now we are moving offices, so I'm working from home every day until November. We were in Waterloo Street, so right across of MPC, but we're moving to Spitalfields area. And it's a really cool office, but it's a listed building, and all the rules with historic buildings that it needs to be very well taken care of. I think there's like hand digging because they can't get machines in and like stuff like that. So just delayed a bit our office. But yeah, in theory, we should be there in November.
So are there any particular advice when you are working from home, when you're not in direct contact people, of maintaining communication and keeping things moving that are unique to work from home?
Yeah, so we always do what we call rounds in the morning. So you you log in usually at 9, and maybe we do rounds 9:30 to kind of get people some time to grab some coffee or whatever. And rounds is just to say hello and see what you're supposed to tackle that day. So say like, hey, Daniel, you're working on this shot. What are you going to do today? Okay, cool. And then you just give us the plan for the day of what you're going to do. And then you check in again later in like a dailies, for example. So you've already been working part of the day. You submit whatever you have to dailies, and then you review it all together. So it's kind of two calls maybe to chat with people and make sure everyone is on track when you're not working together. I think that's pretty important. And then, just chat individually if something comes up with your lead or if you want to chat with another artist about a specific short asset or whatever. So, yeah.
I think with management that I find with 3D, especially some of the more advanced Houdini stuff, in terms of it's quite hard to assess progress. I mean, it's much easier in comp. You can see this shot is better, this key is better, you know, everything sort of is advancing even if it's still a whip. But sometimes in Houdini, there could be a lot going on and you don't necessarily see a lot happening for a while.
Yeah, it takes a while. It's all a process. So, for example, maybe in R&D stages where you're just figuring out how you would get certain effect or how are you going to do a certain thing. I guess it's the slowest stage because you're really setting everything up. Like our last project at the mill together, I can't mention what it was, but there were a lot of trees, if you remember, or effects on trees. Yeah. So just, I didn't do the tree setup. That was our amazing effects artist, but just seeing that iteration with the effects on the trees and how they were going to move, and like, it took so long. But once you get to that stage where you can use all the R&D that you've used, and really see it on the shot, it start making more sense. And then with comp magic, it starts looking pretty. Because at the very start, nothing looks that nice. It really needs that final beauty pass and all that magic that comp artists do. So it's all collaborative effort. So yeah, the start maybe looks like nothing is happening, but it's very important steps to kind of troubleshoot what you can or you can't do with the task that you have, so yeah.
It's amazing how much R&D we have to do, isn't it? Because there are no two shots that are exactly the same. There's always this, oh, how do I do this? Even if you've done it for years and you've done similar things, but there's always, like you say, I've done smoke before, but now there's smoke in trees.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's always something different. And I guess you can't recycle some setups from another job and, you know, tweak it to make it fit this other job. But there's always some time that you're going to have to just sit down and put your thinking cap and see how you're going to do this one. To me, it's my favorite part, actually, R&D, because it's really troubleshooting and seeing what helps and what doesn't. And it's a lot of learning also. You pick up some cool techniques in this stage, so yeah, I love this part of the project. But also, once you see it come together and making it look pretty, it's just so satisfying.
It's satisfying, yeah. I mean, that's what you kind of always want to be at the beginning and the end. I think the least satisfying is when you're just in the middle of lots of projects. That can be a little bit frustrating because you've neither had the fun of the R&D nor are you getting to see how good it can look at the end.
Yeah, exactly. You just see all the stuff I have to do. It can be a bit discouraging, but you know, part of the project.
It's part of the job. I mean, it is also a job. We get paid to do it, so
you
get all this cool, fun stuff, but you've got to do some other stuff as well.
Yeah.
What about what is your approach to reference? So, with something very particular, like a very particular look. What is your sort of go to in terms of finding reference and getting that sort of ready and sharing it?
Yeah, I guess it depends on the project, but you can find reference from everyday life, you know, like just going for a walk, taking pictures of whatever you see, especially if it's nature reference. It's all around you, or trying to replicate reality. So of course, if you notice something interesting, like a tree growing a certain way, or like a interesting ground texture, like it's always good to take pictures. So that's a good one. I'm not an animator, but for example, if you were taking video of yourself trying to act something, or like just finding online reference of what you're trying to replicate, as a generalist, I guess assets, sometimes I don't have access to them. So of course online, I try to find everything, pictures, videos, whatever I can get my hands on. And I mean, as you're aware, we do magical worlds sometimes, so things that don't exist. So trying to find reference of that can be quite challenging. But of course, you can always refer to other VFX shots. I don't know, whatever inspires you really. If it's like a magic, like the show that we finished, which is like fairies and fairy magic, I guess. Nothing is really real, so whatever looks pretty and whatever inspired you, you can always just sneak something in there. So, yeah.
And what about, because obviously we don't get always the final say on how things look. What is your way of working with notes or preparing for notes in advance?
Yeah, that was what was challenging. I guess you always try to hit the brief in the way that client is expecting you to. So trying to be clear with what you were given. We sometimes start to present different options. You don't want to flood the client through the options either, but I guess you try to present two or three different options of what your vision could be, and then hopefully they go with the one that you like the most, but that's not how it happens sometimes. But yeah, in the end, you're making a product, so you have to please the client that you're making things for. So you kind of have to detach yourself a little bit from the final product.
And of course, the secret, I guess, the link between you and the client is production. As an artist, what do you consider makes a good producer?
This one's tricky, because I've had some amazing producers and I've had some, you know, not so great. But I would say a producer that is on your side, on the artist side, is always, I mean, obviously I'm the artist, right? Well, or one of the artists, but sometimes, at least in commercials, you see some producers that try to maybe pander to client a bit too much, or be too agreeable with maybe client requests that are outside the budget, or like moving deadlines forward, and just things that screw your artist over. So I would say taking care of your artist first, that would be great for a producer. Of course, taking notes in meetings. I have producers that don't take notes for some reason, and I end up doing part of the job. That was a long time ago, though. What else would be just keeping track of things, because sometimes as a lead, you have to keep track of so many other things in your own end. That is good to have someone that knows at what stage we're at, when is the next deadline, what we're supposed to send, you know, that sort of thing. So, yeah.
Brilliant. And since we've gone through we've talked a lot about different techniques and softwares and so on, I was wondering what you thought are likely to be the up and coming sort of workflows or tools that aren't necessarily already in pipelines.
Yeah, so for example, as I was talking before, Houdini releasing Solaris and Karma, I think that's going to be amazing. Also the use of USD pipeline. But I haven't seen a studio yet using it fully. I have heard of some studios trying to implement it, but like halfway through a production and it really backfiring, so then having to roll back on whatever they were doing before. But I think that's the way forward. I'm very keen to see how it moves and how studios use their current pipelines and move to the next thing. I think, well, Maya is still very much in use, but I think I'm seeing more people move towards Houdini for just basic lighting, rendering, shading. What else? Unreal. I don't use Unreal yet, but I think it's going to be... It's already very widespread use, but I think they're going to use it more. Like, for example, we're seeing it more in virtual production and pre-production. So a lot of previs being done in Unreal. I think that's really interesting because sometimes you have clients that are not like VFX savvy. And when you show them some previs, like the traditional previs that is just maybe done in like Maya viewport, it all looks quite ugly. So and it's not animated properly. Nothing has like nice textures. It's not really rendered. So sometimes it's hard for some people to understand what they're looking at. But if you show them something more in Unreal where it's like a bit more polished, they have better quality, I think that helps for a client to kind of understand what's going on.
Yeah.
And
it helps them make up their mind earlier.
Yeah, and like using it also in virtual production. So building your previous world and then taking that on shoot and placing your cameras according to the world that you're building and not just trying to put your subject on like a green or blue screen and not really having an idea of what's going to be behind them. I think that's really cool and it's really opening a whole world of possibilities for like Unreal and VFX and us working together. I think eventually it's going to merge and it will probably be a real-time render in the end, but I don't think we're there yet. I think we're 10 years from that, but we'll see.
And we've been kind of talking about real-time renders since I started. I think it's always been the idea.
Yeah.
But it still seems to be 1 hour per frame.
Yeah, you still have to render it in the end. It's real-time, but not really. I mean, you still have to render it in the end if you want to use it for, you know, the effects. But in the side for pre-production and virtual production, I think it's amazing. And it's already merging that gap that we had before, so... I think it also really help actors when they're in a green screen studio. Like, I don't know if you've seen, I think it was the production of The Hobbit when Sir Ian McKellen was a bit, I think he got a bit frazzled because he was acting on his own in this like green screen room. And he was like, oh, this is not acting. This is not what I signed up for. I'm not really sure what went down. But I think if the actors at least knew what was supposed to be behind them and like had a little bit more to work with, I think that would really help everyone. So
yeah, no, it definitely. And DOPs, also camera and DOPs. I mean, I don't know. I often see a lot of shots where they're just framed incorrectly because the camera operator has obviously framed the performers who are in shot.
Yeah.
And there's something very important that should be in shot, or perhaps they've focused on the actor because the thing that should probably be in focus is... doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't want to have the whole shot out of focus because it looks wrong to them.
Right, of course.
But in reality, they're putting something in effects that's here and that should be in focus and not the actor. So I think also, people talk about the actors obviously because they're the famous ones, but I think also for camera and lighting, even light at the gaffer, you know, where they put their key, you know, where they set up the lights or things like that. I mean, it can really help.
Yeah, it's crazy.
It's all merging. What are you learning at the moment?
What am I learning? Oh God, I keep trying to learn things. Well, as I was telling you, I've been, the past 2 years or so, I've made my transition to Houdini. So I've been trying to get better at VEX, which is the coding language inside Houdini, which can get so complex and like all the geniuses that work in effects, they blow my mind, like all the maths and all that stuff. So I'm just trying to learn a snippet of it to make my job a bit easier on some things. So I've been learning that. Karma Solaris. What else? I think that's it for the moment.
I mean, that's plenty, really. Anyone who's ever looked at Houdini knows that that's plenty. What we talked about your early education, just to give you an idea, what kind of things were you strongest at school? Were you more sort of an arty person, more of a math science person?
That's an interesting question. I guess I had always had a terrible memory, so anything that was remembering things, so like history or geography, all that stuff I was terrible at. But math I was actually pretty good at. and drawing. what else I was good at? And I guess philosophy. Those were like my top marks, which is really a weird combination. But I guess it explains also the effects. Is that perfect combo of artistic and technical, so, which I guess is why I ended up doing what I do. So, you know, I have the technical brain, which is, it's, you know, sufficient to do what I do. And then the artistic side of me, that it's also something that you have to keep nourishing and just get better at your arts and, you know, never stop creating on your end.
I mean, the philosophy sounds oddball, but I think anyone that's actually worked in production will realize that if you're able to express ideas, complex ideas, clearly, then that's a really important skill.
I guess. I don't know if I'm explaining these podcasts all right. I'm going to blame it on the language barrier.
I don't really feel any language barrier, if I'm honest. Okay. If I'm ever struggling, it's actually because I have a really bad headphone. So I'm sort of sometimes anyone watching the podcast on YouTube will see me sort of leaning that way. And that's just because I lost the cable to my good headphones.
Oh,
and
I'm using a really bad one. I have this one. Like I'm selling you something, like a new setup.
Oh, I have great Bluetooth headphones, but when I use them for the podcast, I have a cable. And I'm, you know how it is. You always find that you have cables that are just not quite the right size.
Oh,
so.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, so there's a bit of that. But it's been really amazing to finally get you.
Oh, thank you.
On the podcast. And so I would like to thank you again for coming on.
Oh,
and
so much.
We look forward to catching up with you again.
Yeah, thanks so much, Dan. You're doing well.